I think it seems fitting to focus on Joseph Smith's thoughts on this. He, ironically, gave the fewest amount of details of the translation. He always held true to the statement that the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God. And he really doesn't mention all that much after that. But I think that that's one thing that Joseph really wanted to get across, where it wasn't necessarily anything he felt like he could do by himself, but rather he attributes all of it to God. And I think that the historical record is rather clear on that matter. Alrighty, friends. So I think it's my turn again to talk a little bit about Seer Stones. So we just came off the heels of Jennifer doing a very robust and prolific study on
the robust and prolific is code for
the log and Maury.
That was a very long episode.
I didn't say that. I don't even know where to go from there. But the basically, though, we're going to launch into a couple of other sources today, wherein we talked a little bit about how objects were viewed in the Bible, about being able to be harnessing God's power in some way, and we also talked about post-Bible. Today, we're going to be talking about Joseph Smith and how he described and how his contemporaries described being able to use a seer stone or a collection of seer stones to translate, and Joseph was able to dictate the Book of Mormon. So I'm super excited. I don't suppose either of you have any kind of comments before we wanted to get started.
I am just very curious, because there certainly are people who are saying, oh, he didn't use this. And there are people who are saying, oh, absolutely, he used this. What does the evidence say? I think this will be a really fascinating episode.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, especially because both camps are very strong in their feelings. And it would just be nice to get some clarification once and for all so that we can at least decide for ourselves, and so that the viewers can decide for themselves what they are going to believe.
Yeah, and the research that I've tried to do on this really tries to focus on primary sources or sources that are rather early. They also have details that are corroborated, and this is pulling from both members and non-members of the church. So from a historical perspective, I think that there are some really important things that we can learn, and I think that we can arrive at some conclusions with certain degrees of certainty about how Joseph Smith was actually able to translate the Book of Mormon. We won't be able to cover everything, but we'll get through a lot.
Excited to hear your evidence.
I know. Me too. Can't wait.
Okay. Let's get into it.
Okay.
All righty. So for this episode, we're going to be talking about what I lovingly refer to as the mechanics of translation. So what we're going to be doing today is we're going to be reviewing some of the info regarding how people described Joseph Smith translating the Book of Mormon. However, before we launch into seer stones and the translation itself, we need to discuss a couple of things. First, we need to talk about who is witnessing the translation process. This is, quite frankly, the easy part, because we have a plethora of witnesses to the translation process, including Joseph Smith himself, of course, but also Emma Smith, his wife, Martin Harris, Oliver Cowdery, and all the people who scribe for him at different points of the translation. But those are the most notable scribes during that time. Additionally, we also have David Whitmer and his family, and some scholars wonder if some of David's brothers helped scribe at some points, but we know that the members of David's family are eyewitnesses to the translation process, because Joseph, Emma, and Oliver all lived in the Whitmer home during a lot of the translation. So this leaves us with at least a decent sample size of people who were all participants or direct observers to the translation of the Book of Mormon. Now, there's one more thing to mention here, almost as a tangent, but it does relate. Curtains. We have some of these witnesses stating that there was a curtain between Joseph and his scribe, and some witnesses saying otherwise. So, for example, we have reports from Emma Smith saying,
"In writing for your father, I frequently wrote day after day, often sitting at the table close by him, he sitting with his face buried in his hat with a stone in it and dictating hour after hour with nothing between us."
We also have another source from another alleged eyewitness, though this one is a bit trickier. This is William McClellan talking with Elizabeth Ann Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery's widow. And they both seem to state that Joseph Smith didn't have a curtain either. So William McClellan described Miss Whitmer's source as being in the following way.
I cheerfully certify that I was familiar with the manner of Joseph Smith translating the Book of Mormon. He translated the most of it at my father's house, and I often sat by and saw and heard them translate and write for hours together. Joseph never had a curtain drawn between him and his scribe while he was translating. He would place the director in his hat and then place his face in his hat so as to exclude the light and then read to his scribe the words as they appeared before him.
So here we have two eyewitness testimonies supporting the idea that Joseph Smith didn't have a curtain, and so the scribes are able to see Joseph at all times, allegedly. However, we also have some people saying that there was a curtain. That would be obscuring Joseph as he's reading. We have one newspaper who, while trying to cite Martin Harris, quotes the following. Harris declares that when he acted as amanuensis, or assistant, and wrote the translation as Smith dictated, such was his fear of the divine displeasure that a screen or sheet was suspended between the prophet and himself. And I found this quote in particular to be kind of interesting because it implies that Martin requested for there to be a barrier to be put up. It wasn't something that Joseph insisted on, and it was something that Martin specifically requested. And this corresponds to other statements given by Martin, wherein he states that he was almost afraid to look at the seer stone in the hat because he was scared of seeing God because he had read, "No man can see God." So this quote here is particularly interesting because it helps explain that if there was a curtain used, that it was likely Martin that insisted that it was done. And I thought that was rather interesting. Additionally, we also have critics of the church like E.D. Howe, who in his classic book, Mormonism Unveiled, he paraphrases Martin Harris as just saying that, again, there was a curtain. And here's that quote now.
Martin Harris says he wrote a considerable part of the book, as Smith dictated, and at one time the presence of the Lord was so great that a screen was hung up between him and the prophet. At other times, the prophet would sit in a different room or upstairs while the Lord was communicating to him the contents of the plates.
So we have a few sources that kind of disagree with each other. We have a few people saying that he did use a curtain and some say that he didn't. And now we've got E.D. Howe over here saying that Joseph's on the stairs or in a different room while he's translating. So the question then comes to which sources are we supposed to believe? The ones saying he didn't use a curtain are kind of late sources, but then again, all the ones saying that Joseph Smith did use a curtain aren't primary sources, despite the fact that they're at least somewhat more contemporary. This matters because this detail is crucial to whether or not we can trust what the witnesses are saying, because if the witnesses never saw him, then all bets are off. I don't think hope is lost, though, but I do think it's expedient that we put this issue aside for a moment. Let's actually start talking about some of the sources here that discuss Joseph Smith's methods of translation. So we have a few different primary sources that discuss how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. In short, there was a collection of stones, including the Nephite interpreters, also referred to as the Urim and Thummim. Martin Harris, paraphrased by another newspaper, describes them as being bound together by a pair of spectacles. Get a little bit into that now.
The treasure consisted of a number of gold plates, about 8 inches long, 6 wide, and 1/8 of an inch thick, on which were engraved hieroglyphics. By placing the spectacles in a hat and looking into it, Smith interprets the characters into the English language.
So, while this isn't necessarily a primary source, this one does have the benefit of being published in 1830, which is about as early as you can get when it comes to being a contemporaneous account to the Book of Mormon translation. And a few years later, we have W.W. Phelps, who described how the interpreters were used. He's allegedly getting this information from either Joseph or Oliver Cowdery. The Book of Mormon, as a revelation from God, possesses some advantage over the old scripture. It has not been tinctured by the wisdom of man, with here and there an italic word to supply deficiencies. It was translated by the gift and power of God, by an unlearned man through the aid of a pair of interpreters, or spectacles, known perhaps in ancient days as teraphim or Urim and Thummim. And while it unfolds the history of the first inhabitants that settled this continent, it, at the same time, brings a oneness to scripture like the days of the apostles, and opens and explains the prophecies, that a child may understand the meaning of many of them, and shows how the Lord will gather his saints, even the children of Israel, that have been scattered over the face of the earth more than 2,000 years in these last days, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion. And of course, Oliver Cowdery himself says something very similar.
These were days never to be forgotten. To sit under the sound of a voice dictated by the inspiration of heaven awakened the utmost gratitude in the bosom. Day after day I continued, uninterrupted, to write from his mouth as he translated with the Urim and Thummim, or the Nephites would have said, interpreters, the history or record called the Book of Mormon.
Now, these kinds of sources can be multiplied. There's a lot like this, like these sources that describe the Urim and Thummim. But there's an additional level of ambiguity here. We have some records of early church leaders using the term Urim and Thummim to refer to what appears to be one singular stone. For example, Orson Pratt refers to the Urim and Thummim as being a singular stone at around 1852. However, we also have some additional insights from the original reading in D&C 3, wherein the original reading indicated that Joseph Smith used a seer stone. That source is particularly important to point out because the manuscript there focuses exclusively on one stone, and that source is super early, dating back to about 1828. It's the understanding of modern scholarship right now that Joseph Smith used both the Nephite interpreters and a personal seer stone that Joseph had found. For example, we already cited one from M.S. Smith, wherein she describes a singular seer stone being put into a hat. And this account is corroborated by other sources such as Martin Harris and David Whitmer.
I will now give you a description of the manner in which the Book of Mormon was translated. Joseph Smith would put the seer stone into a hat and put his face in the hat, drawing it closely around his face to exclude the light, and in the darkness the spiritual light would shine. A piece of something resembling parchment would appear, and on that appeared the writing. One character at a time would appear, and under it was the interpretation in English. Brother Joseph would read off the English to Oliver Cowdery, who was his principal scribe, and when it was written down and repeated to Brother Joseph to see if it was correct, then it would disappear, and another character with the interpretation would appear. Thus, the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God, and not by any power of man.
Martin Harris describes a story wherein Joseph Smith was able to tell that his seer stone had been replaced during the translation process, indicating, again, that Joseph Smith did use a singular seer stone, at least during parts of the translation. After switching them out, they went back to translate, and Joseph turned to Martin and said, "Martin, what's the matter? All is as dark as Egypt." Martin's countenance betrayed him, and the prophet asked Martin why he had done so. Martin said, "To stop the mouths of fools who had told him that the prophet had learned those sentences and was merely repeating them." Martin was also paraphrased in another magazine, wherein he described the translation process in the following way. Martin Harris related an incident that occurred during the time that he wrote that portion of the translation of the Book of Mormon, which he was favored to write direct from the mouth of the prophet Joseph Smith. He said that the prophet possessed a seer stone, by which he was enabled to translate, as well as from the Urim and Thummim. And for convenience, he then used the seer stone. Martin explained the translation as follows. "By aid of the seer stone, sentences would appear and were read by the prophet and written by Martin, and when finished he would say, 'written.' And if correctly written, that sentence would disappear and another appear in its place. But if not written correctly, it remained until corrected, so that the translation was just as it was engraven on the plates, precisely in the language then used." Other people affirmed that Joseph Smith used a seer stone as well, including Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and more, and there are certainly lots of resources that help indicate that. You can look on our website to kind of check that out if you wish. But this leads me back to the previous question about whether or not people saw Joseph Smith while he was translating. To answer this, some critical thinking is required. We can ask ourselves the question, why do we have some similarities between these accounts at all? The fact that we have corroborating details from each of the witnesses suggests to me, at least, that they actually saw Joseph translating. Even if there was a curtain during some portions of the translation, there are too many similarities to discount all of these accounts coincidentally matching the way that they do. The historical record seems clear. Joseph Smith used both the Nephite interpreters and the Urim and Thummim during the translation process. And so to kind of wrap up some of the findings I was able to whip out, there are a few things. So there were portions of the translation process where Joseph Smith used the Nephite interpreters, and there were portions of the translation process where Joseph Smith used a personal seer stone. And I think it's a little bit interesting. There's a little bit of conflict between each of those accounts, specifically about what instrument was used when. Some of the witnesses, including David Whitmer and Emma Smith, indicated that Joseph switched to using more of his personal seer stone after the lost manuscript ended up going missing. And so there's a little bit of a timeline there and a little bit of a shift in terms of what Joseph was using to translate. But it does seem rather clear that at least during portions of the translation, both the Nephite interpreters and the seer stone were used. I think it's also clear that these witnesses are somewhat reliable, because even if Joseph was perhaps obstructed by a curtain during portions of the translation, each of the witnesses clearly saw him well enough to affirm that he either didn't have any manuscripts with him, or to see him using the spectacles or the seer stone, either by fixing the spectacles on the breastplate that was found with the plates, or by placing the spectacles or the seer stone in a hat. Now, much, much more can be said about how Joseph dictated the Book of Mormon, whether the Book of Mormon is a tight or a loose translation, and other important questions. However, to wrap up, I think it seems fitting to focus on Joseph Smith's thoughts on this. He, ironically, gave the fewest amount of details of the translation. He always held true to the statement that the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God. And he really doesn't mention all that much after that. But I think that that's one thing that Joseph really wanted to get across, where it wasn't necessarily anything he felt like he could do by himself, but rather he attributes all of it to God. And I think that the historical record is rather clear on that matter.
So that was totally interesting for me. I geek out over history all the time, so I think that that was fascinating personally. But what do you say to people who would say that, you know, critics of this idea will often agree with sometimes believing members of the church that there's something embarrassing or shameful about using the seer stone? And so do you think that they're kind of ceding ground to the critics to base that argument off of?
I think that there's something to be said there, because one of the, I mentioned E.D. Howe in my, yeah, in kind of my research there. And he really tries to hound this point, wherein it is something that is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. The Urim and Thummim isn't something to be taken seriously. But I think that one of the benefits that we've had to kind of researching what you talked about in the biblical text, mm-hmm, and also post-biblical text, is that there's been a long history of people trying to interact with God, mm-hmm, in that way. And in lots of instances, God being able to use physical objects in our, mm-hmm, world to help reveal his will to us and also to help other people. I mean, we wouldn't have the Book of Mormon. I'm not sure if we would have the Book of Mormon if God wasn't able to or willing to work with what Joseph understood, mm-hmm, about his day to kind of let us have that, the wonderful text that we're able to kind of cherish together. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right. No, I think you make a really good point, because, you know, Joseph was a kid. I mean, he was 21 when he got the plates. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a kid and he did not know how to receive revelation. So I think it makes sense that Heavenly Father would teach him how to use revelation using something that he was at least sort of familiar with.
Mm-hmm. You've been kind of quiet, Jen.
I do have a little bit of sympathy for the people who find it embarrassing. It's a strange idea, but in order to stick with that point, this is embarrassing, you would have to ignore thousands of years of history. Mm-hmm. It's not like this practice just grew up with Joseph and he invented the idea of using physical objects. Like my episode and Sarah's episode are like 2 hours of proof. You would have to ignore all of that to really, really stick with it. It's embarrassing. It's odd. It sounds funny to our ears. But a little understanding of what things were like in the past does go a long way.
Yeah, I imagine it must have been very weird for you hearing that story for the first time.
It was. Eventually, I got to the place of, well, there's weird things in the Bible. Weirder than a seer stone. People come back to life.
Talking donkey.
Talkies, yeah. like the Red Sea parts, all kinds of things. And I'm used to those because I grew up hearing those stories.
Right.
When you hear the seer stone story, it feels shocking when your adult brain is the one that interfaces Correct. With it first.
Yeah, I think Zach and I both said at one point that we both learned of it when we were about 12.
Yeah.
So we had time to acclimate to that idea before we reached this point.
Yeah. So I have a little sympathy for the it's embarrassing folks.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can hold that position with any like intellectual honesty if you know anything about history.
No, and I do feel like basing your arguments off of that does let the critics frame the argument.
Because Absolutely.
For Joseph, it wasn't embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just what he did. It was part of his life.
And it wasn't embarrassing for the people that were around him. They were literally helping him do this.
Yeah. There are stories of the apostles like cherishing mm-hmm. the seer stone and thinking it was just this magical, wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that this is going to be a very interesting next couple episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because, you know, despite how we may feel, because Jen, I appreciate you mentioning your kind of rocky relationship, if you will,
yeah.
with talking about this sort of thing.
Oh, it's terrible.
My rocky relationship with the seer rock.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're the worst.
I'm amazing. Jokes aside, though, I do think that it is important for us to be able to kind of have empathy for people who may be at different stages. That's one of the reasons we're talking about this,
yeah.
right? We want to be able to help people kind of understand this is the history behind it. This is why we don't think it's as weird as maybe mm-hmm. some of the critics make right. it out to be.
Yeah.
And
empathy, while at the same time saying there are answers to this. This right. is figure outable.
Yes.
But that kind of leads in rather well with the next episode we're going to do, which I believe Sarah is
yes.
going to take the lead on.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about what happened to the seer stones after Joseph died. Mm. And we're going to be talking about why there was a period of about 50, 60 years or so where the church just didn't really talk about these things because that's important. We need to know why. There are generations of people who grew up never hearing this.
And the accusation is, oh, the church hid it in a means yeah. to deceive the members.
They lied about
yeah.
it.
There's a really actually some rational explanations for why this
yeah, happened. Yeah, so we need to talk about all of that and find out what those reasons are and see if they are rational.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it'll be great.